Thank you very much. I would like to ask Dr. Soper, Dr. Amadero, Dr. Asif, and Dr. Venerable, who you're here, to join us at the podium. While they walk over here, I want you to think about if there are things you forgot to say. You go, oh, I should have said that. Or would you like to mention now, like acknowledgments, or commercials, or jokes? And while I'm allowing them to get here, I want to thank the audience for joining us. This morning, we have started with a terrific presentation of young faculty, progressive thinkers, dedicated professionals who are focused on improving the outcomes of patients with chronic and end-stage chronic kidney disease. We have learned today there is a promising novel treatment for sepsis, the biospleen. We've learned today, and we've been refreshed, that access optimization is an important question still being unanswered. That dedications and practice are needed to develop successful hemodialysis access interventions and prevention of stent abuse. And most importantly, we learned just now that a healthy small intestine affects the protein level delivered to the colon. The last point I would like to stress in our presentations today is that interdisciplinary team approach is vital to the success of our treatments. Communicate, communicate, communicate. Walk to the VIR suite. Go to the OR. Visit with your team members. Ask their opinion. Millennials have to talk to Gen Xers and baby boomers. Find a way to communicate. Thank you. Time for questions. Please say your name and your institution and your country.
Alan Matthew, Eureka, California. I missed the beginning, so I apologize if I'm asking something already addressed. Two questions. In both the adsorbents and in manipulating the diet, the hard endpoints are about going to end-stage renal disease, but what about uremic symptomatology and the clinical indication to initiate dialysis with any delay? And second question, when the diet is that manipulated, were we following patients' weight, not necessarily A1C, but other measures of glucose tolerance?
Thank you. Yes. First, concerning symptoms and so on and delay of initiation of dialysis because you affect also symptoms. Certainly, I mean, this is not new. There's also some old data by, if I remember well, Jones that used dietary fiber also as a kind of a sink for just ammonia because there's some kind of recirculation, liver, portal system to the intestine, and then back recirculation. So certainly these dietary fibers do have an impact on urea too, but also, and this is new, on these new toxins like phenols and indoles and so on and so on. And it's certainly true that these dietary fiber, or just by lowering dietary protein, what we already know, that because if you lower dietary protein, you can postpone the initiation of dialysis because you decrease the symptoms in these individuals. This is also, I can only tell you that we also, in one of the studies, just looked by a questionnaire, by a survey to symptoms, and again, there was a correlation between these metabolites and the symptoms, the typical uremic symptoms that these patients have. So certainly they contribute to the symptoms of patients. This was a cross-sectional study. So the next step will be that you do an intervention and just look again at all these symptom scores and see whether there's an impact on the symptoms, yes or no. So there is no prospective data so far. Second, concerning the impact of the dietary interventions on weight and so on and so on, I think we don't lack, we lack this data. We don't know. But there is, at least, there shouldn't be, in my opinion, an impact on weight and malnutrition. The most important point in avoiding malnutrition in patients is to increase the energy intake, and this is by means of carbohydrates. So, if you just lower the protein intake and you have enough dietary energy intake, I think this won't affect your nutritional condition too much.
My concern in the U.S. anyway is avoiding protein seems to just increase carbohydrate and weight increase here as opposed to, it's not a balanced change, and that we have far more weight gain in the patients that I've seen in the U.S.
Yeah, it's always, I mean, I completely agree, of course, too much is too much. That's certainly that's the case. So, I mean, it's a little bit difficult to find the right balance in this. But some patients, certainly, if I look at my own patients, their intake of energy is too low. We should increase the energy intake and not too much focus on the protein intake.
Thank you for your question. May I go here to the front on my left-hand side, please?
Peter Stenekel from Stockholm. This is a question to Peter Venable. Thanks for a nice talk. More of a comment, actually. This is regarding this extremely interesting paper that was published 17th of December last year, just before Christmas, by Hazen's group, actually showing that you could affect TMAO levels and atherosclerosis by giving an choline analog, 3,3-dimethylbutanone, that you will find in certain food items such as vinegar and red wine. And it could show, they show very nicely that giving this to these ApoE knockout mice prone to atherosclerosis, you could completely prevent the choline-induced atherosclerotic lesions by giving a compound that is found in some specific food items.
Thank you for pointing out. Yes, very interesting data. And again, it's proving that not only by altering the diet, but also by altering the metabolism, you could affect, you could have good outcomes just by, like you said, by adding something which interferes with the metabolism, could have a good impact on health. So, yes, I agree.
Thank you. Dr. Kotanko?
Yeah, thanks to the speakers for their really excellent presentations. I have two questions. The first one is actually for Dr. Venable. You've shown nicely the increase of uremic toxins in the course of CKD. Is there actually any data which indicate that what target levels should be achieved in patients with CKD? I mean, we as nephrologists, we are so driven by treating to certain targets, be it KTOV, be it phosphorus, be it levels of other metabolites. But, I mean, I'm just wondering, is there certain levels for specific uremic toxins you think would bring the patient in a kind of safe territory based on the outcome studies? I know these are mostly observational data, but based on the outcome studies you've seen and analyzed.
I think it's an excellent point, Peter, you just raised. Is there some kind of a cutoff level below you don't see the risk you see in our patients? I cannot give you the answer. I don't know, because so far we only looked at this and we looked at relationships between the metabolite, both in a categorical way and in a continuous way, but so far we didn't, explore if there's some kind of, toxic threshold level that should be avoided. I don't think so. If you ask my personal opinion, I don't think so. I think there's a continuous relationship like with many other metabolites. And in fact, I'm currently moving towards the field of the general population. As you can also see with regard to the TMAO, there they started with the general population, and the levels they have seen in their population were very, very low. And even with these very low levels, at least according to the CKD world we live in, so even with these very low levels, they were able to see, almost a continuous increase in the risk. So I think it's a continuous risk. The higher, the worse. So no clear cutoff.
Thank you. May I ask a second question?
Yes.
This question is directed towards Dr. Madeira and Dr. Asif, actually. I mean, it's a little bit frustrating to see the slide Dr. Madeira has shown about the failure of excess surveillance. And I'm really wondering, does the frequency of surveillance make a difference? Say if you would have technically means in place, which would allow you, imagine on a per-treatment basis, to identify routinely excess function. Do you think that this actually could make a difference in outcomes?
I think that's a very important question. I believe we're going to learn more from the HFM study. I think if you have, despite everything I said, I think if you have a good vein diameter, a good vein depth, and the flow of the fistula, then basically you're good. And I think, you know, we will see those results. But I think those would be the only independent predictors as whether giving surveillance to the vascular axis based on these parameters and having more surrogate outcomes in the future would change our practice. I am not sure. You know, I'll be also interested to see what Dr. Aziz has to say.
So the question is valid, and the randomized studies that have been conducted are didn't have good design and were limited by sample size. The sample that you need to have a meaningful conclusion is 863 patients. And there is a study now underway, a randomized study. Hopefully we'll have the answer in a few years.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The gentleman here.
Mohammad Al-Haji, Henry Ford Hospital, second year fellow. The first question for Dr. Soper. What do you think about using the biospleen in patients with sepsis, not on dialysis, like meaning they don't need dialysis per se, just using it to clear the sepsis? What do you think about this idea?
Yes, definitely thinking of it to be using to treat, you know, with catheters, CVVH, that kind of treatment, over, you know, a 1 day to 1 week process where one could use different filters if each of them gets clogged in the case of a large amount of pathogen. Yes.
The second question for Dr. Aziz, what do you think about using ultrasound to access the fistula in the first few weeks after creation? Would that reduce the complication? Would that affect the access failure rate in the future?
Excellent question, and something that I have been thinking about because ultrasound is now portable, small ultrasounds. But we need to do a study, and I think we need to compare it to those nurses who are just extremely good in accessing the arteriovenous axis and seeing cost as an issue, right? So every time you have cost, you have just simple physical examination, and if it's equal, examination is going to win. But something that I think that I'd be interested in collaborating with you if you were interested in that. Good point.
I'm going to move to the back so that I alternate, please, in my right-hand side.
John A.J., Long Island University Post. I'm a prospective registered dietitian. I have a question for Peter. I want to know what strains of probiotics are more effective in maintaining the integrity of the gut microbiota in patients with CKD.
Thank you for asking me, because I didn't cover the probiotics in my talk. I mean, this would again bring me too far away. There's certainly some data on probiotics, so you could try to alter the microbiota composition in the patient by giving live organisms which survive the transit through the small intestine and then end up in the colon could have some beneficial effects. But where the evidence of the prebiotics is already tiny, the evidence for the probiotics is even less. So, I mean, this is very supported commercially by several companies stating that this other one probiotic is giving you health benefits. I think the evidence is very, very limited. And this is belief, and belief is no science. I completely agree. But I think you better just try to alter the environment of the microbiota towards, I mean, a more beneficial microenvironment so that the microbiota adapt themselves towards a more beneficial composition than to just force some kind of new germs into this hostile microenvironment. They won't survive for a long time. That's my let's say, general view on the discussion pro versus prebiotics.
So then the symbiotic you mentioned actually has the pre and the probiotics together,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So how then do you put them together if probiotics is not effective?
Like, well, I mean, it's very difficult to disentangle what's the contribution of the one and the other. We don't know. So, again, I can tell you just that the evidence is more robust for the prebiotics, at least in my opinion, than for the probiotics. And also it's some kind of a philosophical open of mind, that prebiotic is more, let's say, what I would expect to give some kind of long-term benefits.
Thank you.
Thank you. Gentleman to my left.
Yeah, John DeGiertis from Chicago. My question for Dr. Benipuel, also a gut biome question. So we know in non-uremic patients that a high-fiber diet is beneficial, lowers cardiovascular risk. And how much of that do you think may be due to transit time? And what's the time course of generation of these bacteria? We know that in dialysis patients, we tend to limit whole grains and high-fiber foods because of the phosphorus. We tend to limit the fruits because of the potassium. And I don't really know of any data comparing gastrointestinal transit time in dialysis patients or and controls. But one thing that you could alter without changing how people eat is to give them a lot of psyllium, for example, give them a lot of a mild laxative so they have one or two bowel movements a day. And would this significantly lower the PCS and indoxal sulfate levels by just not giving bacteria enough time for these compounds to be generated?
Yeah, certainly. It's not only by giving them more time. It's also, I mean, I've shown you the slide from Cummings showing the nice relationship between transit time and production of the phenolic compounds. It's not only time, but it's also because of more incorporation in the bacterial protein synthesis. So the two ways why this dietary fiber is decreasing the production of PCS and indoxal sulfate. But probably could be that just by giving a prokinetic could be sufficient. I mean, like you suggest to decrease the production of these metabolites. I can tell you only that obstipation is really a neglected problem in our patients. So many patients on dialysis do have obstipation, meaning to some extent related to a long transit time in the large intestine. And so just by a simple maneuver of increasing or hastening up the transit time could have a good impact also on the production of the toxins and could have on the long term have a beneficial impact on heart outcomes. Again, this is just a thesis and should be supported by data, but it's a very easy measure, could have important implications.
Yeah, and two other factors that I forgot was, low water intake and lack of exercise. So if you think about it,
sedentary.
You almost have a perfect storm to increase the dwell time of all of these toxins in the gut.
Again, so and also the drugs we are prescribing.
All the
medications also have an impact on the again, the colonic microenvironment is very, very pushed towards, producing protein fermentation metabolites. So, and again, by exercising, that people more exercise more, that they move more, have a look at their drugs, their medications, diet. So it's a whole package you can just tackle to have an impact on the production of the metabolites. Yes.
But basically, nobody's studied this yet.
At least in my knowledge, no. I mean, this colon has been a neglected, completely neglected part of the body for years. It's only last 5-10 years that people get interested in the colon as something else and just for losing stool and so on. I mean, it's something new. Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm glad there are fellows in the audience taking note of what you're hearing. Dr. Sands.
Hi, Jeff Sands, Orlando. I have a twofold question for Dr. Asif, and I'm sorry I forgot your name. I wanted to know a little bit about your thoughts about intraoperative ultrasound. Years ago, Ali Bakrin and some others looked at doing intraoperative ultrasound and looking at the access flow at the time of creation. I forgot what the cutoff was. I think it was about 230 or 40 cc's per minute. If it was lower than that, that fistula wasn't going to develop. And they would modify their procedure in the OR until they got a better fistula, as opposed to if it was higher, they did pretty well. that's one approach. And then the second is, years ago, and I know you were part of it, we looked in the state of Florida. Half of the accesses in the Medicare population were placed by surgeons who did less than five or less access placements per year. Clearly, that's been shown to have adverse outcomes. How can we as a community prevent the amateur hour in the OR?
Great questions. First of all, I agree with that approach of intraoperative ultrasound. Ultrasound is such a tool that provides you amazing information, and you're absolutely right. That was 230 cutoff officially that had that flow within minutes of creation. Reaching that flow, they had a better outcome. We published that, in, I believe, in 2007, somewhere there. Many people don't do that. Many people don't do that, and I don't know why. I think it's such a simple tool that you can employ right there in the OR to have meaningful information about how a patient would do. I'm sorry, I forgot your second question.
The experience,
yes. So, again, in the state of Florida, those were the data, and at least in Miami area, to address this, it really is about commitment. Are you committed for that particular patient that's in front of you, the dialysis patient? We were at University of Miami, and we did not accept the status quo of our surgical support at the University of Miami. We questioned it. And I did a study, a prospective study. I sent patients to a surgeon who was dedicated in our area, but was not part of the medical center. And we showed clear difference, 7% failure versus 35% early failure. Which surgeon would you pick? Pseudo-competition and politics and those type of things set aside. We know what the right path is. We often do. And it's just a hard line to walk. Surgeons, clearly, there's clustering in the VA, big VA study. There was a surgical experience that matters. Tools are important. Standardization of the technique is important. But most of all, our willingness to just accept the status quo is also a major problem. And I think in this room, these are leaders. And I think you should question that component. If you don't get the right type of care, you should seek the right type of care. You should raise the concern, and you should ask questions. I think that's the only way we can get past this. There are communities where there are amazing accesses in Paris, in London, in California, and I think we can get that in Kalamazoo, Michigan also, if you are committed. It starts with you.
Thank you.
If I may take another, these might be conflicting observations. I was very interested by the lion and the gut change. So I'm going to ask about the lion and then about bariatric patients. On the lion side, I think they actually die relatively early for mammals, and there is renal failure in them. Did I miss the implication of the gut change there? Conversely, at least in our area, and I think everywhere, there's a lot of post-bariatric with malabsorptive procedures that are coming to ESRD, which I think had a lot to do with oxalosis, but maybe not. Could you balance the
Interesting points you raise, but I don't have any data. I mean, about, for example, the phenolic levels or the indole levels in lions should be interested to know what's the phenolic and indolic compounds are. So I don't know. You're saying, of course, also these lions do die early on, but I don't know what other reasons. So I'm certainly not an expert in lion medicine. Let's say that way. So I, probably you know better as I do. So
I'm not either, but I know that Paul Menes at WashU, probably in the 70s or 80s, studied at the St. Louis Zoo, and recollection.
We'll discuss during the lunchtime. I mean, I'm really interested to do some studies on lions too. Yes.
Bariatric patients?
I don't know. I mean, there's also a field we need to explore what's the impact of bariatric surgery on the microbiota. I think this is really an completely underexplored area that certainly needs to be addressed. I mean, this could certainly give some interesting new views, but again, I'm not aware of studies looking at it. I should go to the PubMed again and see whether or not there is any data available on let's say, the impact of bariatric surgery on the microbial composition, the metabolomic impact. So certainly good suggestions, but at least in my knowledge, I don't have any data to share with you.
Madam?
My name is Marie Schwartz. I'm a nurse practitioner from a nephrology practice in Queens, New York. My question is for Dr. Asif. About a year ago or so, I was at a vascular access meeting. We actually have them every month with the vascular surgeon, our nephrology practice, and the interventional radiologist, and sometimes some of the nurses come along. And I had asked the question to the surgeon, would he change his surgical technique and use the slot instead of the, you know, the JA, being that we know that the incidence of stenosis is so great? He's been in practice for about 35 years, and I think he's a great surgeon. And he said he was willing to do it. And then the interventional radiologist said, oh, but that would be very difficult for me. Easier for him, but difficult for me. And actually, it ended right there. So my question is, are surgeons doing this? Is there a call to do this? Should I push the issue when I get back?
So I'm very happy, first of all, that you raised the issue and you asked as a team member to the surgeon of certain procedures. I'm unclear as to what part of the procedure that interventional radiology was not on board with. If it is a situation where he or she didn't know, that's okay. There are so many things that we don't know, and I think the more appropriate thing is that I'm willing to learn, because that if that helps our patients, I am on board. That's a roadblock, saying that I don't think I can do that, hence we're not going to go in that direction. And I think it's a process, and it's a strategic, and it's a team approach that would win. I would encourage you to go back and ask what component of that was difficult, and can we come up with a platform where we can help you? Because ultimately, it's going to help something that we all have a dog in, that is the patient. We all have a dog in that race. Patients' outcomes directly affect us. So my suggestion would be to go back and ask, what is it that's creating a difficulty here?
Very well, sir.
Hi, Brian Remlow from Dartmouth. Based on what we heard about the microbiome and such, do we know for sure, every month we have CQI and we push the oral nutrition supplement program with Fresenius and we try and get the albumin levels, we just focus on that. Do we know as an independent variable whether that's improving mortality? Should we be giving these shots of Procell to our patients every treatment, or maybe we should be giving carbohydrates instead?
I'm not aware of any, let's say, the policy of FMC centers and nutritional support. So if it's really for every patient showing some kind of malnutrition, do add just high condensed protein supplements to improve the albumin levels. I don't know whether this really is the good approach. Again, certainly you will have an increased production of this PCS and indoxyl sulfate, I can tell you by sure, because we have done some studies where we have given healthy controls, just giving a supplement of some kind of condensed protein supplement from a company, Nutritia. So we just increased the protein content of their diet, and we saw a significant increase in the production of pQ-resol. So I can imagine the same holds true in the end-stage renal disease patients, prescribed these kind of high protein supplements. So it certainly will increase the albumin level to some extent, but again, I'm not an expert in the field of nutrition, and probably Peter Stemwinkel could help me, but I probably think that you certainly should combine it with also energy intake in order to have this protein being used for protein synthesis and not only just being degraded due to the catabolic state of the patient. So again, blindly prescribing every patient with low albumin some kind of supplement will certainly help some patients, but could do more harm to other patients.
Roberto.
This is Roberto Pecoa from Brazil. A couple of years ago in Vegas, Chris McIntyre and myself, we had a debate about mechanisms that would increase the translocation of these compounds to the circulation. Chris was favoring the ischemic event during the hemodialysis session, and I was favoring the overhydration and the gut edema as a cause. What's your opinion about this?
I won't come into struggle with you either. So I don't know. I think both could be the case. I certainly believe, I certainly favor Chris McIntyre's hypothesis of intermittent ischemia during dialysis causing translocation and causing inflammation. Whether edema in itself is having impact on let's say, on the translocation. Probably you have the data, but I didn't see them, but I don't see all data. Sorry.
Well, dear audience, oh, there's one more question.
Hi, I'm Michael Letter. I'm from Fresenius Medical Care in Asia Pacific. I would like to invite Dr. Asif and Dr. Madero for a comment. I really appreciate your presentations, but what I see in many parts of the world, it's not just the silo between the nephrologist and the surgeon. It's the issue that there are good surgeons and good nephrologists and poorly trained surgeons and nephrologists. That's a little bit what Jeff Sands says. And I think that's probably one of the issues that we have. We talk a lot about how to manage complications of vascular access, but the issue is to avoid the complication in the first instance when you place them. So, for example, in the region where I'm working, we see a great issue with the training of people who put the vascular access in place. And I don't care too much if it's the surgeon and the nephrologist. I have to disclose that I'm actually trained as a surgeon, so maybe nobody talks to me during the lunch break anymore. But it doesn't really make too much of a difference to me as long as there is a proper training. Do you have any recommendations how to put this in place that we avoid a situation that I've seen, for example, nephrologists after an 8 or 10 hour nephrology session with 60 outpatient patients, they say, oh, I have to put two fistulas in place and go to the OR. And I can tell you just when they enter the OR what the result of this accesses will be. So what is your concept, your recommendation that we could take on to kind of guarantee or put a quality control concept or something around the expertise of the people who put the accesses in place? Thank you.
Soren Shenoy, some years ago, put together a program. He's a surgeon in Washington, Missouri, St. Louis. He is at WashU, Washington University. His thought was that clearly you need team approach. You need monthly meetings with the surgeon. So all the complication, all the access procedures are discussed there. But he thought that mapping is one tool that a surgeon should perform instead of a radiologist or nephrologist. He felt that the surgeon at the time of creation is the best person to perform mapping. He showed some results, and those results led to fistula creation in over 87% of the patients. I agree with him. I think if this technique, this tool is in the hands of surgeon mapping, I think that'll make a huge difference. In addition, the monthly meeting that you mentioned with surgeons and nephrologists and interventionalists, and more importantly, nurses and techs who are part of that entire team are important. This is easier said than done. At University of Miami, we were at it for over a decade. And we were able to have an impact on fistula creation, but we increased fistula from 27 to 50-some percent. Still, we couldn't go to that 80 range that Soren enjoys. I believe that the surgeon is critically important, but surgical training and their expertise, more importantly, their willingness to work with others is important. In my previous life, I was a pediatric surgeon. I know the mentality. And I know how we thought of others. We thought we were the best. That mentality still goes around. still goes around. But there are those surgeons who work with others who feel that they're part of a team, and that's what Soren brings to the table. And clearly, he's got in the range of 90% fistulae. I mean, that's how to do it.
Thank you.